You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Hey, get a rhythm. When you get the blues, come on.
Come on over to Rhythm Shack with Mike Fisher for high energy roots rock, Americana, jam bands, blues, and more. Every second and fifth Monday from 3 to 5:30 a.m. That's Rhythm Shack here on 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland and KBOO.FM.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of An Oregon Story, saving our beaches, farmland, and more. Screening from January 17th through January 31st across multiple venues in Portland and beyond. This film documents the history of Oregon's efforts to protect its coastline and save its farmland from urban sprawl. The documentary features archival footage and interviews with the individuals who helped create Oregon's land use planning program and defended it for the past 50 years. Again, that's a documentary film screening of An Oregon Story, Saving Our Beaches, Farmland, and More, from January 17th through January 31st across multiple venues in Portland and beyond. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to the Talking Earth, Martin Luther King Day, here on KBOO Portland. This is the Talking Earth, the second longest running poetry show in America, perhaps the world. I'm your poetry jockey, Dan Raphael. We have long cuts from Tony Artizzoni, Mindy Netafi, and Mark Ziggins, plus a triptych from James Yeary. I'll read a couple poems. Have a good mix tonight of voices, approaches, and worlds, and let's just get it right going with Tony Artizzoni. Warning to Talking Earth regulars, this is prose. Tony Artizzoni is the author of 5 novels and 3 collections of short stories. His award-winning fiction has been featured in literary journals and anthologies. His work has been reviewed in the United States, Canada, Italy, and Greece. He's reading tonight from his newest novel, In Bruno's Shadow. And here's Tony.
Thank you, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to read this evening from my novel, In Bruno's Shadow. It was published this year by Guernica Editions in Canada. In Bruno's Shadow is a book about exiles and pilgrims, about people from populations that have been displaced by global events beyond their control, as well as those who have the means to travel in search of some small measure of meaning. It's also a book about idealism, about hope, about beliefs that go beyond the stern measure of science, and about positive thought, or what some might call prayer. That's from the publisher's description. I'm going to read a section that takes place in Rome, Italy, February 2005. "You have a hole in your heart," the old woman said. On the table before her, the cards were spread like a cross within a half circle, with some figures sideways and others upside down. The old woman from Napoli smelled of ground peppercorns and some lotion or ointment Massimo's nose couldn't place. Her face was like an overripe apple left to bake in the sun. She wore a widow's dress and shawl and, on her second finger, a ring with an oval stone the color of smoke. A friend of Massimo's mother. The woman was visiting Rome for a few days and reputed to be so accurate reading the cards that when she was younger, crowds waited in line wherever she ventured, bearing money and gifts. Of course, since she was from the South, the woman was in touch with these things. All she asked for in return was caffè corretto and, if it wasn't too much trouble, some nice pasticcini for her sweet tooth. That and a modest donation, a few coins for the care and well-being of her dog. She gazed up from the cards and smacked her lips several times, eyelids fluttering like butterfly wings. "I see that you're often misunderstood, mistaken for someone else." "That's true," Massimo said. An ox of a man with wide shoulders and soft eyes, he was dressed casually, in blue jeans pressed with a knife-sharp crease and a cotton sweater the color of desert sand. He'd just come from work, from his station outside the Colosseum, and had plans to go out on the town after he walked his mother back to their apartment. "A shame," the old woman said. "You'd be much happier if people could see you as you really are. So many secrets." like locked rooms in a big house. Not common in a man so young. It would be better if you threw open the shutters, let in the air and light. Massimo said nothing. No matter, all will clear in time, for some things soon. I see you meeting a man, someone who will give you advice, which you must follow or else there will be a great calamity. He'll be sent by a woman in red who will give you a blessing, but here, with a long yellowed fingernail, she tapped one of the upside down cards. Here, deep inside you, I see an old simmering anger, a powerful acid, burning all it touches. It wants to bubble up from where you've buried it. And here, again she paused, here there's an abiding sadness. This card shows the wound. For a young man, you've suffered greatly. Massimo's face remained calm and unchanged. Here I see someone else, someone close to you, taking a journey. Is one of your relatives or friends on a trip? Or perhaps that person is lost? You too, I think, will soon take a trip, but not the same one as this relative. I see a long road stretching out ahead of you. A hill with many rocks, a steep mountain you'll be challenged to climb. I see you carrying some sort of weapon, perhaps a sword or knife or club, to protect yourself from being wounded again. The pair was sitting at the kitchen table in the friend's apartment. A plate of frappe, deep-fried ribbons of crumbly pastry sprinkled with powdered sugar, lay beside their coffee cups and bottle of grappa. Though it was the week before Marta di Grosso, Massimo was not in a carnival mood. He knew his mother, Renata, was in the next room pretending not to overhear what the old woman had to tell him. He'd consented to see the Napolitana only to please his mother. She was sick with worry about his father, who seemed to be living backward in time. Still, Massimo didn't want all of his secrets exposed. On the stove's front burner, behind them squatted a well-used Mocha Express, its bottom blackened, a smudge of coffee darkening the lip of its spout. At the foot of the stove slept the old woman's ancient dog. Across the room, gazing down on Massimo and the old woman, was a silent Jesus Christ pinned to a dusty wooden cross. It was the story about the dog that had attracted Renata's attention. Her friend claimed the dog was even more talented than the old woman. Apparently, the dog's sense of smell was so keen it could detect sickness. All one had to do was bring the dog into a room with sick people and it would sniff here, sniff there, and if deep inside someone's chest or leg or armpit a cancerous tumor was hiding like an onion or a beet, the dog would let out a howl and push its nose into the skin beneath which the tumor was thriving. The dog was also able to see souls as they passed from the body. More than once, the dog sat at attention before someone about to die, resisting all commands, foregoing all food and water, remaining still, eyes unblinking, often for hours, twice for more than a day, occasionally giving the air a series of sharp yips, until the moment the dying person let out a final breath. The dog would then slowly lift its head, its eyes fixed on the space immediately above the body where the dead person's soul would hover, like an uncertain cloud waiting for a decisive wind. Once the spirit began moving, the dog would track it until it flew up through the ceiling or down through the floorboards, and then the dog would sleep. This wound, I see it lying near the area of love. There you sometimes struggle in the darkness, nearly as if you're fighting. In the area of love, you've been hurt deeply, yes? Who hasn't? Massimo said. The old woman's eyes held him. For a long moment, neither said anything or moved, and Massimo sensed she understood. Such big hands, the old woman said, finally as her arms reached across the table toward him. So calloused and rough. Such shoulders and arms. You're a Hercules. Yet I don't see that you're a common laborer. From the other room came Massimo's mother's laugh. You work outside in the sun and rain, but there's something on your head. Massimo stared at the sad-eyed figure on the cross. The old woman released his hands and reached for one of the frappe and broke it in half. Powdered sugar feathered down onto the tabletop. You're like this, she said, thrusting one section of the sweet toward him. A part of something that once was whole. Now, she gave Massimo a shrug, something broken. She ate the part that wasn't Massimo, then sipped her coffee and ate the part that was, too. He needs a wife, came his mother's voice from the next room. She wants me to marry a second cousin, Massimo said. The old woman turned her head to the wall as if listening. Her eyelids fluttered wildly once again. At the same time, the dog lifted its head as well. After many moments, the woman looked back at the cards and added, "You won't marry this cousin." She hesitated, then poured some grappa into the coffee remaining in her cup and drank it, then refilled her cup with grappa and took a deep sip. "Understand, I make no judgment, though I caution you to take care." She gestured to the air for more coffee. Massimo stood and refilled her cup. "I know others are waiting and you need to leave," the old woman said. "But still, I see you with a baby in your arms. Yes, un bambino. A very old and gentle soul deserving to be swaddled in the finest cloth, covered head to feet with gold and jewels." Certainly part, if not all, of what the old woman from the south revealed was true. Nearly everyone who saw Massimo at work as he paced outside the crumbling walls of the Colosseum thought he was a gladiator. They looked at his red cape and tunic, his shining steel breastplate, his leather cingulum belt studded with grommets and gold coin accents that glistened as he moved in the sunlight, and imagined him inside the Colosseum's pitted walls, sword raised. Only later, as they noticed his ringed bracers, the leather sandals that he carefully cross-laced from ankle to knee, his steel helmet with its curved red horsehair plume, did it occur to them that perhaps he was dressed as a Roman soldier, a legionnaire perhaps, or a centurion. If they were familiar with Roman history, they knew Massimo's helmet was worn by centurions, though rather than wear the plume from ear to ear like a partial halo, as true Roman centurions did 2,000 years ago, Massimo wore the plume forehead to neck, like Russell Crowe and the other men in the opening battle scenes of the famous North American movie Gladiator. Il Gladiatore was Massimo's favorite movie, even more than Luchino Visconti's Rocco and His Brothers, though only a blind man could deny the breathtaking beauty of the young Alain Delon. If Crowe and Delon ever walked past the Colosseums, Massimo knew which one he'd follow. Regardless of accuracy, he was something from history, or at least he pretended to be, and everyone who came to Rome knew the place had history in spades. Nearly every tourist wanted to be photographed in front of Rome's ruins, to be able to show their friends and family back home that they'd stood in the presence of the truly ancient. Was there a greater symbol of the ancient world than the Roman Colosseum? This was the service Massimo provided. For only a few euros, he offered tourists the chance to be photographed beside him with the pocked travertine walls of the towering amphitheater in the background.
Thanks, Tony. And here's a poem from We Are Mermaids by Stephanie Burt called Frozen is the Most Trans Movie Ever. Because it was snowing in our transparent hearts for 100 minutes or 40 years, and because the ancient rocks, while well-intentioned, have big ears, they're older than Satan and bent on finding a hero and a leading lady and singing to them till they make a perfect match. For every lady, they believe there exists a perfect catch. Because the deleted scene is the chaste male lead pretending to be a fisherman from mysterious lands, because fractal isn't a word other princesses know, because we learned it in math. We were afraid our parents would be canceled in post-production for shame for the god's own wrath, because the pre-sexual is so much like the post-sexual or the post-compulsory heterosexual, because life on Earth depends on the anomalous fact that liquid water contracts while ice expands. Because what matters the most, or maybe just what matters first, is not who you kiss or want to kiss, but where you let yourself hold hands. Yeah, just to let you know, I throw the show together just kind of randomly. It's not like one piece relates to the other. It's more like getting some difference in angles. Our next reader is Dr. Mindy Netafee. Mindy is a poet, artist, educator, and somatic trauma therapist. She has been teaching creative writing and performance for more than 15 years and currently teaches storytelling workshops for literary arts, produces and hosts for Backfence PDX and The Moth, and serves as director at the Center for Artist Resilience. She has published 3 full-length poetry collections and a how-to book on poetry, Glitter in the Blood. Her latest collection is Open Your Mouth Like a Bell. And here's Dr. Mindy.
Hello, this is Mindy Netifee. Thank you so much for listening. I have some poems to start out with that are sort of wintry heartbreak poems. And then we're going to kind of climb our way out. That's what I'm feeling right now. These first poems are from an older book of mine called Rise of the Trust Fall. And this first poem is called All I Have to Say for Myself. The last time you came to see me, there were anchors in your eyes, hardback books in your posture. You were the 5-star general of sureness, a crisp white tuxedo of a man. I was fiddling with my worn coat pockets, puffing false confidence ghosts in the cold January air. My hands were shitty champagne flutes brimming with cheap Merlot. I couldn't touch you without ruining you, so I didn't touch you at all. It's when you're on the brink of something that you lose your balance. When I can't bring myself to say what I need to, my heart plays Russian roulette with my throat. I swear I fired that night, but nothing. Someday, I'll show you the bullet I had for you after time has done the wash. I'll take it out of the jar of missed opportunities. We'll hold it up to the light. You'll roll it around in your mouth like a fallen tooth. We'll both laugh about how small it is. Wonder how such a little thing could have meant so much to anyone. Okay, this next piece is called Tremolo, which is a reference to a move when you're playing the piano where you sort of play 2 notes right next to each other very rapidly, moving back and forth in a way that creates tension. All right, tremolo. When my father began selling off his things, he put off unloading the Steinway baby grand piano as long as possible and had the decency to call me when it was time. He was practiced at postponing disaster. The piano was the highest ticket item he had, and I knew how badly he needed the money, so it meant something. The sign of a great piano is how quietly you can play it, is what he told me when he bought it, when he was at the summit of his happiness and self-philanthropy. He had this gleam in his eye back then, when he was entertaining guests that I mistook for joy. He would brandish the glossy black back of it like a pet whale, like an endangered species he had become close friends with. He would be sure to point out where Henry Z. Steinway, great-grandson of the patriarch himself, had signed it, just inside the haughty curve of its hip. What is hubris, anyway, if not the signal of great imagination, of someone who has let the true self float up like a hot air balloon? What would you jettison to stay in the soft, bright clouds just one more day? At the time, I was still in love with my father, the way children are. The dark growth of his mistakes was weighing everything down, and I wanted his weakness to bring out something gentle in me. Even though I had learned the pathetique on this piano, even though I had scaled its fingers with my fingers nearly every day for 7 years, even though I could close my eyes while seated at any table and see the keys take their positions like skinny dancers on a chessboard and play the blank wood perfectly. I told him, "It's okay, Dad. It's just a thing." Then placed the phone back in its cradle, my eyes burning, my hands shaking, my heart hammering out the song that isn't a dirge, but how a dirge begins in the mind of the composer when she is still trying to get a handle on the shape of it, the swelling, changing shape of the loss. Whew, thank you. Let's break out of the sadness and with a magic spell poem. This is from a newer book called Open Your Mouth Like a Bell. And as you can see, I'm going to try to entice Winter to be good to me. All right. This poem is called Prayer to the Gods of Winter. You are the fanciest gods, triple doctors of the cold dead life. Your cloaks, long and still and billowing like statues of ancient queens, those arcing silver collars of stiff silence, that shit is elegant. We open our robot throats to you. You fill us with your melancholy moog. You're so goddamn cool, wooing us with your murdery wind chime grace. You make our complaining sound French and profound. You turn our hearts into hard diamond dervishes. You teach us to party like mirrors, like unmanned ships in forever distress, like moaning waltzes in F sharp. We say lonely, you say free. We say armor, you say cocoon. We say abyss, you say invisible harbor of the crooning mother nothing. You holy, holy thieves, you steal all the light, all our light. And only when we've given it up willingly at last, you return it to us as water dressed as glass, as fields of bright blue snow. Fuck the moon. Fuck the gods of spring. Those cheap showgirls. We don't need their bare legs and curtains. We don't need their green raffle tickets. We've won. All right. All right. I'd like to turn to some poetry of the future coming spring, and also mostly just some poems that are about my sweet mother. This first poem, also from Open Your Mouth Like a Bell, is called My Mom Listened to Coast 103.5 Love Songs on the Coast pretty much all of 1985 and 1986. You can take the woman out of the church service. Hymnal memorized, eyes closed, heart bursting, praising Jesus in song. And place her in the driver's seat of a beat-up, unregistered, rust-colored sedan. You can take the woman out of the Christianity even. Replace it with the swift religion of food stamps and late rent checks and ungrateful daughters. You can take the woman out of the running for solid ground completely, but you cannot take the earnestness out of the woman. No! Not if Lionel Richie has anything to say about it. Not if Linda Ronstadt has anything to say about it. Not if Chicago, Foreigner, and Atlantic Star have anything to say about it. Not if the orgy-ready tenor sax of Starship, the warm mink coat of Luther Vandross's vocal cords, or the stiff drink of Whitney Houston's sustained high E over C have anything to say about it. And thank God for them. There was a brief tear in the American continuum of medicalizing women's unhappiness. Somewhere between the classification of Quaaludes as a Schedule I drug in 1984 and Prozac being made available for prescription in 1986, and my mother fell through it hard, landing on the triple event horizon of desperate loneliness, single parenthood, and Reaganomics. Maybe you've never been swallowed by a whale like that. You'll have to take my word for it when I say that all that was standing between her and ongoing nervous breakdown was the steady stream of pop power ballads charging from the car stereo. You'll have to believe me when I tell you how defeated she looked in the mornings, or how tightly she would hug me and my sisters before hustling us to get ready, or how wrenchingly sincere she was when she would say, "I cherish you girls. You know that, right?" And how I loved and hated the cinnamon gum and Folger's coffee on her breath. You'll have to picture us pulling up to the elementary school to the rhythms of a shaky carburetor and my mother belting out both duet parts of Up Where We Belong. Imagine how completely embarrassed I was to be seen with her. I wanted to disappear, to pretend she wasn't mine. And I also was in awe of her, because her love was like every guitar solo that comes before every bridge. Her smothering, irrepressible love was the bedazzled breasts of Dolly Parton in a made-for-TV Christmas special. It was bawling in the cinema's love. It was big and corny and unsophisticated and totally unprepared to raise three daughters on its own. There was no village to turn to, just the hits. And it takes exactly that much Phil Collins, exactly that much Wham, to make it through. Whew! Okay. Another poem for my mother, and that is also my origin story. This poem is called Labor. The story goes, my very pregnant mother was on her knees in the wet earth of the small vegetable garden at the side of the house, trying to get the soil turned and the seeds sown and the seedlings in, because it was the third week of May already. Because my father had said he was going to do it and had not done it. Because the sun had come out, and you know how the sun is, with her whistling strength and foolishness into the body. The labor came on suddenly and early, the way a spring sometimes does. I slid into this world swiftly, smallly, easily, without asking anyone's permission. Some babies respond to the cosmic whale croon of a cresting full moon. It was the earth herself that called to me, with the songs of graves and surrendering that cannot be heard but only felt in the semicircular canals, in the spinal cord, felt in the feet, felt especially when the hands come down to join the feet, and then felt in the knees, which want to please the earth by pushing down soft depressions of their knee moons into her. I can feel this beginning in me, even now. My mother on her knees in the sun, damp with sweat, breathing in the sharp slap of fertilizer and the heady ditty of young tomato leaves. My mother swaying like some priestess of the bedrock. My mother laboring in the year of the earth goat, Mars in Margaret Thatcher, Saturn in Jimmy Carter. My mother stubborn digging in a corduroy skirt. My mother not making the mistake of leaving work to men. Thank you. One final small poem. This is called O Ginkgo, and it is a prayer poem to the ginkgo tree. a 49-million-year-old fossil was found. A 49-million-year-old fossil was found, with leaves of ginkgo biloba pressed into it like small perfect fans or bells, finely veined, so that they photograph like the undersides of mushrooms, like the ancestors of lungs and accordions. Why we aren't building temples to ginkgo trees in every place, everywhere, I am not clear on. The genome of the ginkgo tree is 3 times as complex as the human genome. I am mostly a stranger to genomes, but no more than I can be to anything that is at my center. Ginkgo has defense mechanisms for its defense mechanisms. While synthesizing chemicals to fight off insects, it is also synthesizing chemicals to attract that insect's enemies, and also probably adding especially spiritual chapters to the art of war. It withstands pollution, disease, salt, drought, can spontaneously change sex, all while announcing autumn with this elegant golding, this egg yolk butter sun golding so bright and gentle you might think you are hallucinating spring. When the atom bomb detonated, annihilating and incinerating, charring even the air, the roots of the ginkgos of Hiroshima remained unscathed. In only a few days, they sprouted new growth above ground. Let us pray. Oh, ginkgo, teach us, great tree, how to be complex enough to be this complex, how to be vast enough to grow beyond our history while not denying our history. Teach us how to survive ourselves. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mindy. And that was something very different. I say I like to combine things from angles. This is called the Grasshopper Triptych. It's by local media raconteur James Yeary. It's 3 poems, and it's combined with music by Dana Junifersen. So here is the Grasshopper.
They have matching armbands from where the sun is drawn. It turns out the monsters are starving from the windows, public safety, eyeing you like Oedipus, invisible in the seat of a grown-up dreams grind and full-bleed park bench. Bridgework rompers, derelict fencing, rhymes the construction site, trailers where punch was tied to a chair for breathing broods to wind up jaws of RNA world. Close up the house. Your tattoos and waves promising you'll come back as a ribosome. In a cemetery, some aspect of my mesonym associated with suspended ball. A bougie transplanted warlock advised the will to let their spirits touch. There must be some place all these hallucinations interact. Come to me. Underneath the ice giant, a warm world slowly ground. My lord said it wasn't worth finishing. Round earth grinds against all the quills and lifts. Out of the dream, I can't lift my pen. Can't let you off the bus just yet. Cerulean is the plastic petals, this one worth remembering. Face of central air frozen in the eye of sky dying, decided the sun need not set between poems. Wouldn't have thought you could catch that from a grasshopper. Hollywood Transit Center knocked off its access as the city congealed. Bulldozed 10 city under freshly painted mural reading Choose Love. Tarp billowing in the sodden landscape between the bridge and where the Blazers play. No faucet to look in on what happened. Just clean shirts reflecting the judge of boys to come. They can slide off their easement for dirt and tossed in the pit where hammers reconcile. Echoes can share their genes too, like in this poem. Heroic couples across the desk in horizontal zine exchange. Having a cold is his disease, reads him his odyssey. A cedar assortment of the best of our brimstones. Edgeworn war stories brought lit up from spit for batai. Coral codices in an electrified padlock bank box leased by Senator Bora. Inseminating lasers from the eyes of mitochondrial Eve. Fires out of Africana, Americanas, If bacteria from the mind of Milton elected the Roman generals, imagination helps to differentiate from the real. Anthropopose taught button martyrs to the gene had aligned along spectra. It looks like you fell into a brain when they were passing out assholes. Electric excitation pulls differentiation from the remains, but where is it transposed? Looking up to the amoeba and behaving like fire ants and water. Human condensation opening a vesicular gateway to surviving life world. Our bodies may have a separate awareness withheld from this somatic prison, moving further and further out by cold corridors of inspiration. Caves implied by every imagination orbiting the fiery distances, where the magnetic charge transfers when the mode of nickel stops flowing. The behemoth held together by a variety of mechanisms cornered in the eye of space, programming dictates override its references moment to moment, encouraging not just differentiation but mistake. The leisure suit bonded to the skin of the white alligator is concealing the light source, hydrogen highway, time portal plated with cancers. There are religions being developed on your skin. Rub up on some soap for good luck. Stars busy boiling water, places we'll never visit, under the dipper dragging my rake against a cauldron. Cassiopeia, also called the cardboard box, wake to find two grasshoppers staring at me through the tense mesh. Later, one sits in a plastic spoon and snacks on a morsel of rice pudding, unfazed as Brian holds it a foot from his mouth. Girl selling patriots touches her navel till I notice. Shopmate apologizes for pulling off her sweater. Someone is blowing bubbles. Baby fat and bodysuits don't hit on the host, daughter, vulva, snapdragon. Do you want to lick the table? A regular electric flash outside my window turns out to be lightning, unwieldy atmosphere built by man. But it does rain a little in bursts, and I move the bikes or the boxes of furniture under the awning, leaving a rough day at work to be surprised by a rain shower. How does that make you feel? And a strange friend suddenly appears at the horizon, lying down on the floor behind the rear seats, where he tells me we've come to spy starlight, bursting through a cloud before dawn. Delia reaches into the tent, gently cupping her hands around the grasshopper. You can hear the little dogs outside over the Leonid engine, our steel shells shaking. Don't ever think a pagan is a fascist. A true pagan kills his king. Dox the cranks. Reverse the vaccine.
Well, thank you, James. And again, variety, poetry, multimedia. So let's just move back to something more conventional. This is a final feature, visiting from the Bay Area, Mark Ziegens. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. He's a poet, spoken word artist, and a creative development advisor. He's the author of 5 collections of poems, including The Book of Clouds, Boys in the Woods, and The Underwater Typewriter, as well as 2 spoken word albums, Marker and Parker and Nightwork. Mark will be reading at Annie Bloom's Books on the 16th, tomorrow, if it's still the 15th, along with Larry Beckett, who was on this show last month. So here's someone you've probably never heard before, Mark.
Hi, my name's Mark Ziegens. It's a pleasure to be joining you all today. This first poem that I'm going to read is from my collection, The Typewriter Underground, and it's an example of creating a mythic character or an archetypal character and bringing it into a present life setting. This particular character's name is Hyacinth Coyote, and the poem goes like this. Reborn on the hour, each hour, a ritual of spring equinox, performed in a shuttered mountain lodge, shake shingled, hunch shouldered, topping Thoreau's undulating country of clouds, embraced in Melville's gaze from Arrowhead, dark bitten, bewitched, unforgiven, haunted by unpardoning old coot, a premonition of hawthorns, perhaps, or then again simply nature's shakes of trees on immobile granite. Catching monadnock winds blown 80 miles to the dense massed pile above Greylock Glen, yawps and howls this purple-eyed trickster delivers into the migrant sky, gape-mouthed, back-throated, shifting shapes of clouds, rendering them as spirit animals. With each bawling burst, this scrawny scree-loper announces the forgiveness of all sins, dying and renewing at the clock chime. In 24 convulsive cycles, this western-born hyacinth coyote sits between chaotic convulsions at the dining table of the old lodge, her pale blue Olivetti MP1 resting steady on the new lacquered wood, the dim glow of a tortoiseshell desk lamp lighting its keys in the final hour of the poised day that divides sun from moon. This next poem is called El Poema de la Caja, the poem of the box. It was published in Alchemy magazine last spring, and it's an illustration of sort of bringing magical realism into the poem and creating a world unto itself. So here we go. Your walls, summer citrus, salamander, yam, skip troweled Spanish lace, traveling beside stained and polished concrete floors, the color of mole coloradito, resting in a bisque earthen bowl, undulate like your hips under the red silk dress you wore the night we met. They are as if your dance was transmuted to frame, fixed yet flowing, carving and cleaving space. After your ringed and bangled arms rose to the June sky, the tips of your fingers kissing clusters of stars, moving them into shapes and patterns never seen, the firmament erased, replaced in a moment with surety and delight, the heavens your canvas, matter and light your paint, the swirl of the starry night you made, brought down by hand to this house of stucco and flame, cactus and rain, copper and stone, a seed, a root, a branch, a shrine, a stair to an altar, a veer, awakening at the landing beneath the final flight of tiled risers painted and fired in the domed kiln beside this house filled with mesquite, fixing the signs you gathered in your sleep on the roof beside the parapet, in the bed of forged frame and white embroidered sheets. This house, a container for the dreams channeled through your heaving body, covered by loose woven white cotton, red threaded along the opening at your throat, your black hair spread thick on the pillow, your face turned to the moon, ornamented order rising on your in-breath, passing to the walls on your exhale, one fresco, set by morning, the murals of the day, dancing before children, rubbing early sun-eyed eyes, as you squeeze oranges into cobalt blue glass, then sit behind plated huevos con chorizo, bare feet, a fork, cool flame. This next poem is about bringing mythic characters into present-day life, and it was, as you'll see, appropriately published in the Subterranean Blue Review. It's called Hauling Up Mermaids. The days of summer boats now gone, the gray-sprayed rock jetty silent, cast out, cracked and quarried to break the line of winter swell, full mouth dead waking, an apparition. I put up the mast, fastened stays, recalled lobstermen with rock salt loaded in shotguns who fired when we came too close to their pots, striped and chipped buoys, a warning. Dropped in centerboard and rudder, hoisted sail and took the tiller, gliding out from the small harbor, spindrift spatter burning my cheek, blood raising, a recognition. The quiet chop and lap of waves against the hull, sitting windless, in a fog bank, tasting of kelp. I could feel the long-carried rot in this diffusion, a sign. And into my mainsail came gasps, a gathering of distant cries, the sounding of expiration, reflected between the gunnels, raising cilia, a toxin. Calling winds that set me running through the sea fret, an ancient tar enshrouding these sullied waters, sail set wing to wing, hull planing in the mystic. A summoning that lifted me out of myself. I was simply hand on tiller, skimming silent into the white. I felt a pull, as if true north had fixed my eyes, a quickening, covering distance without time, until there was a hole and light, a shaftway beacon through the broom, to a windless strewn splash, debris floating round a tattered gill net, four bickered bodies torn and spent, sucking and spitting surface brine, their white skin gone greener than scales, tails drained of iridescence, caught in lines and mesh, a trawling. As my left boat came round and by, it was their eyes stripped of all sense, so wide and lost, their world betrayed, eyes beyond asking and sorrow that were as mine, a communion. And then there was the work of it, drawing near the net and folding the wood-handled knife bought in France with the metal collar you twist to lock the blade, a steadying. The cutting, the reaching, the lifting, the embrace of a near-dead soul, the scum of the sea on her skin, her tail's erratic final beats, and then the next, a lament. Three backs pressing against the foredeck, and one leaning on another's shins, breathing slowly on the port bench as, like the others, her tail turned to a vapor, a becoming. Their conveyance done, the fog opened to the afternoon sun. I could feel their thoughts traveling between them like a sea current, invisible and fast, a flow. Connected again by touch, this group of once oceanids resonated with a low hum, their eyes clearing, their hair losing the stink of the sea, arising. And then one spoke as a chorus, the others in naked unison, swaying with the tones of her voice. Do you remember when you pulled her bleeding from the sea? A rescue. I nodded. Her hair was short brown then. It is gray now, you wouldn't know. We were there. Far beneath, we tasted her blood, saving her. And you from the sharks. A blessing. So she is in and among us. And we are connected to the land through her and through the life you saved. And you sat shivering in your boat because you gave her your sweater, the color of seawater and peat, a conduit between our worlds, like the fog that brought you to us, with the knife you carried all these years, cutting us free to live on land. Now that our world has been destroyed, we can never go back. Sobbing spread between them, shaking the boat, causing furious waves to rise, crashing over the hull, awake. The roiling dropped, then ended. The westward sun had found the land, casting a stripe from harbor out, bringing us warmly into the bay and the promise of different lives. This poem is called Plattsburgh. It's from my Boys in the Woods collection, published by Crane Maiden Press. In the campsite by the tributary up the 7 miles, we'd lined our canoes to meet the dirt road in Chibougamau that would carry us to flowing highway, descending to Quebec, New York border, fresh baked donuts of the Price Chopper siren scent, calling us down to Plattsburgh, where our freeze-dried, tightened stomachs would gorge on grease, glaze, chocolate, and sprinkles, as if we discovered ambrosia. We played blackjack in rip-stop nylon tent, the smell of fisherman's dope and cutters, and jeans worn for 2 weeks in the bush completely unnoticed, as we turned cards on which our Price Chopper dollars were staked. I played with perfect consistency, cleaning out canoers who one by one crawled on stiff knees past the mosquito netting, out from the tent they'd entered at sunset, wondering how they'd ever pay for donuts when we returned to the land of plenty. And when only 3 remained, all money zipped in the side pocket of my backpack, I retired the cards and we went out into the high-skied Canadian night, onto the plateau above the river, eyes turned to the promise of Aurora, waiting for the northern lights to whisper and streak, green and white and ice-edged blue, in these last moments at the end of man. And so it was, when only one and I remained, that the sky filled with flash and streak, arcing radiant up from the forest to heavens, growing stronger, brighter, as if the earth were sliding quick under the polar ice caps, so hot grew the icy reflection. Traveling so fast now, we could almost hear it, this colossal display of rising light that now we saw came from a logging truck, bearing down toward us from the higher camps, laden with timber to be cut and milled, knowing that we wanted now, badly, the wild. I'm going to share with you now a few poems from my most recent collection, Lion Street, which my friend David Scott Ewers described as a San Francisco of the mind. This one's called Unclasped. At steep ravine, I took you into surf, your fear breaking faster than the hard waves, spit and sparkle, lips, teeth, lids, and brown hair bouncing as you jumped in the shore breaks, waves rising round your thighs, foaming. I took your hand in the hollow between two curls and led you to deeper waters. You looked back to shore, scanning for your boy, a thin line of love tethering you to shore. You would not go beyond the second break. The line, a kite string too long, would be cut if you ducked with me into the black swell. Your arm extended, holding me, fingers unclasping slowly, at last releasing, as I turned my young back to your kind face, diving into the cold, quiet beneath. This one's set in San Francisco's North Beach neighborhood. I call it Double Sonnet with a Flavor Shot. Tonight I'm a mourner for when the Keystone Corner was on Vallejo, where I heard Art Blakey play and Denny Zeitlin say, I'm going to do a little number with Charlie Hayden on the bass. Tonight I turn and remember the Spaghetti Factory one December, flamenco dancers stomping in the back, ruffled dresses, black heels going clack. Against the faded floor, memory, a paramour, fading in the mist of the one I kissed at the Savoy Tivoli, now only reverie, lost in the Grand Street bustle, a schlock shop hustle, across from the postcard store, selling remembrances of evermore, in the land where jackalopes play, giant bunnies hop away, Edgerton's bullets stop, they say, as I try to grapple with what was that's actual, and what's at best, blue smoke curling at the old Trieste. This one's called San Francisco. Hard talk against an empty wall. Does it bounce off? Or is it absorbed, a canvas of silt, moving sediment as paint, reduction of thick, finding bottom color. Removing the mask, I shed all value to this room of kink. Can we begin something here, she wonders, speaking through me to her broken parts. Van Ness, concrete and jumble, a broken spine that once led to the head of this city that remaindered its soul. Bob's Donuts on Polk. 2 a.m., limited, cheap, grease and sugar and green light, has heart, and offers a kindness to this hungry, broken soul who read his heart out to an empty room and perhaps saved one, before taking whore's wages, then exiting the now empty house of pleasure, mask in a bag, unloved, utterly alone. And finally, I'm going to read the closing poem from the book. It's called Starting. I ride the sea on purple curl as night draws near. Arms back, head thrust, leading with my draw. Water drops and rises as we progress, wave and I, till it scatters on sand in turbulent wash. I roll in the froth, stand shaking water from my head like a dog, turn my back on darkening beach and scrubby hills, look out to the sun-puddled sea slipping between my toes, inviting. I run then plunge, duck diving under the swells, a locomotive pumping. Each time I come up, the light has drifted further, calling meet me. I give over to the tide, letting it carry me into the white, marveling at how fine a line the sun paints on wrinkled chop. In the moment before she slips beneath her covers, I survey the distant black, taste the salt, and start to swim.
Thanks, Mark. And kind of round things out with some poems by Diane Seuss, a book called Frank Sonnets. And hey, it won the Pulitzer Prize, but I like it anyway. And yeah, none of the poems have titles, but we'll start off with page 84 and page 85. In the dreams, my mother called my name from the lower levels. I called her name from the uppermost level, but not mother, but the name she was stuck with when she was born. She never liked it, nor her hair, called it bushy, but didn't really care. I take some comfort in her knowing I was there. The crowd kept her from the climb. It wasn't in her nature to rise. Slept on sugar sacks in the cellar when she was a kid. From my vantage point, I could see the whole sky, the totality, horizon, circumference. Funnel clouds of every ilk snaking in our direction. When she was 5, she lied to the barber, said he was to cut off her hair as short as a boy's. After the tornado hit, I ran through the wreckage to find her. The peasants on the lower levels had drowned. I called her name again, loud. An old woman sat on a folding chair, humped like a witch, in charge of the dead. My mother, my mother. The old woman pointed to a body in a line of wet bodies on the floor. I screamed the scream of giving birth. She was what I had, or all I had, or all I had left. It is hard to remember dialogue and dreams. I dreamed of it again. My dad's body lost to us again, but finally found again. We set him in Dickinson's coffin, wooden, painted white. Where had his body been all these years? Things felt strange. I could see the stitches holding my dad's eyelids shut, but lo and behold, his eyelashes, so long they tangled now and then, were still intact and at his throat, like Emily's. A nosegay of violets, a pink cirripedium, and 2 heliotropes in his hands. I loved his hands. They were not large hands. They cut and sanded wood. They had a fineness, a delicacy. It was said after Emily's little nephew died, she became delicate, would not even let the doctor feel her pulse, just walked past the door so he could diagnose her via a glance. My mother and sister added bluebells to his coffin, but they called them sweet peas. I don't know why. I don't know why I miss Emily so, and him. Why die? Why dream? Here's the sonnet on page 8. Sometimes I can't feel it, what some call beauty. I can see it, I swear, the conifers and fat bees, ferns like church fans, and then the sea, its flatness as if pressed by stones, like witches were, the dark sand ridged by tides, strewn with body parts, claws, the stranded massaglia of the moon jellyfish, transparent blob, brainless, enlightened in its clarity. I stand there. I walk the shore at low tide, the sky fearless, not open to me, just open. There it is, the wind, cold, surf's boom drowning out thought. I can photograph it, I can name it beautiful, but feel it? I don't know that I am feeling it. When I drown in it, maybe then. Okay, one more. Page 31. Labels now slip off me like clothes when I was in the dark with some daddy man, and I could turn anyone into a daddy man with my stupendous mind, which is how I thought about things when I was 14 and some half a rapist was scraping the tears off my cheeks with a milkweed pond in his 2-room house on the riverbank. So many boys back home lived without parents in Fuckerson Park, where some of us teetered ready to tip onto dirt. Roads where shacks were painted Kool-Aid colors and nameless. Parkways led to Bob's Country Club, and all the dogs were named Pee-hole. And one big colonial prefab from when the Lord led Rosé to the right lottery ticket, which wasn't worth the resentment heaped on her by the rest of us. Even Jesus, she said, resented her and smote her that way he does with 1,000 paper cuts, which made the rest of us feel better. And that is the job of Jesus, the most daddy-ish daddy man of all. Again, a good book to check out, Frank Sonnets. Diane Seuss, like me, she doesn't capitalize her name. I can appreciate that. But hey, thanks to my 3 featured writers, Tony Artizzoni, Dr. Mindy Netafy, and Mark Ziegens, to special guest James Yeary, to Talking Earth founders Walt Curtis and Barbara Lamorticella, Talking Earth's host, producer, and engineer Patrick Bocard. Thanks to all you listeners and all the supporters of KABU who make this transmission possible. I'm Dan Raphael. This is the Talking Earth. You know, I always try to put in a plug for poetry here in Portland. More needs to be done. There's more happening. There's no central place to go to find out what's going on in terms. Again, thanks to the bookstores that carry poetry, PALS, Mother Foucault's, Belmont Books. There's plenty I'm not thinking. I don't get out to bookstores much. Who does? You know, we all shop by mail, but this is radio. This is KBOO. I'm Dan Raphael, and we'll close off clumsily like this. Thanks for listening.
Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Hey KBOO listeners, KBOO cut through the clouds during our end-of-year campaign thanks to support from listeners like you. When we meet our campaign goals, we can continue to bring you colorful, radiant rays of radio. Thank you, and keep tuning in for unique music, cutting-edge news, and transformative public affairs on the airwaves.
We invite you to participate in our brand new public affairs program, Once Upon a Time. Share with us your memories and touchstone events of your life, of your journey. Join us first and third Friday of the month from 11 to noon here on KBOO 90.7 FM and available online at kboo.fm.